Hi, I'm Connor Friedersdorf, a staff writer at The Atlantic Magazine.
Hi, I'm Michael Brendan Doherty. I'm a contributing editor at The American Conservative, and I sometimes wear other hats now, too.
Yes, you are the founding, you can call yourself a founding editor now.
I'm the founding editor of The Slurve, S-L-U-R-V-E. Yes.
An esteemed title, and so tell us about The Slurve, your a very exciting new project.
Okay, so I had this idea for a couple of years, and I tried it once a little bit, experimented as a blog about baseball. The slurve is a slider curve. It's a pitch that some people use. It's a little rare to see it used because it seems to have the disadvantages of both a slider and a curve as well as the advantages. So in any case, I decided I had a couple contracts in the past year end or run out, and I was also feeling a little I was longing to write more about sports. I've started writing some features for ESPN Magazine occasionally, and I had this experience where I wrote a piece about the Indianapolis Colts quarterback Andrew Luck, and it went out and lots of people read it, and I didn't get a single email saying that Andrew Luck is a member of the Illuminati and that I'm helping him destroy America. And so I thought, wow, this is really different. You know? This is exciting. And so I've kind of decided to strike out into writing about baseball every day. So I run a paid subscription newsletter, and what I do is I write a little bit of my own thoughts about kind of what are the stories driving the day at the beginning, mm-hmm. and link the best work, and then I have news, the best or most relevant, most informative news items, stories, columns about every single team that played the night before, that was off the night before, etc., and then a few goodies at the bottom. So far, I launched it last Friday. And so far, it's a minor hit, I'll say.
That's great. And so, is it pitched at people who are, you know, baseball fans who are, like, enough of a baseball fan that a SportsCenter roundup isn't quite enough? They want more than that?
Yeah, it's pitched at fans. So here's my ideal. It's pitched at a lot of people. So. And the first person it was pitched to is me, which is this. I found a persistent problem, which was that it was very easy for me to follow the team that I love, the Mets. But I like the whole sport. I like the whole pro sport, and even like kind of the minor league game at this point, the prospects. But when I tried to venture out beyond my own team, I was faced with an internet full of noise and junk, you know, right. Like just rage-inducing lists, fake debates, just contrived junk content all over. And also, like, unreliable bloggers and things like that. So it just takes a long time to get to the good stuff. So I'd seen other newsletters that, as a journalist or whatever that I've subscribed to, that have been really helpful to me. So there's your Long Reads newsletter, right, where you send out a couple of stories every week, and, you know, I would miss those if you didn't send them to me. Mm-hmm. Then there are things like Ben White of Politico does this Morning Money newsletter. And it's great. It's better than having an RSS reader because I have an experienced editor telling me these are the important stories every morning. Ben Domenech does one called The Transom. I find that really helpful. So I thought, where is this for baseball? And the thing I wanted didn't exist, so I thought, why don't I do the work of doing it, of creating it, and then I'll see if others like it. And so far they do, I think.
So this is one. What you're doing is something that you're seeing more and more journalists doing. You were talking about some people who are doing it in the political space. And one thing that I wonder is, it seems like we're starting to see, or maybe we've already seen, the end of the kind of open web era. You know, someone like you who had this idea 5 years ago, 6 years ago, might have thought, I'm going to start this as just a blog and try to build an audience and hope that I can turn that into people, you know, voluntarily hitting the tip jar, or people, you know, turn it into maybe a part-time gig that someone pays you to do over time, as a lot of bloggers made that transition. And now a lot of people, myself included, have decided that we're going to do something that's pay only for a kind of niche audience and try and go in that direction. Do you have any additional thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had messed around with this as a blog 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I found I didn't like the way it aligned my interests and the reader's interests. So to do that as a blog, you have to have either the right audience, exactly the right audience for advertisers, or a massive audience. And I found I couldn't pursue my distinctive vision and do that at the same time. And I've been inspired by even software developers. I can't remember how to pronounce his name, but the guy who develops a bookmarking site called Pinboard. He said, you know what, I'm building this product, but you're going to pay me to use it. Just an initial fee, and then he has a service on top of it that you can pay $20 a year for. And the idea was, his idea was, he increments the price to use it by one penny per certain thousands of numbers of users he has. And the reason he does this is because he wants his business to be sustainable for the long term,
right,
and not to go through this cycle of trying to grow yourself into a million users first and then getting a bunch of angel investors to buy 70-80% of your equity and then hope you grow to a billion users and then sell out, you know.
Right. Yeah.
That, for most companies, that's impossible, you know. It's like buying a bunch of lottery tickets. So to me, the idea of, okay, I'm going to offer a service and people are going to pay me for it, it just makes a lot more sense to me. So, and like I said, it's inspired by other people. It's like the idea is I have a distinctive vision. You know, part of my vision is, you know, there's not going to be any, like, weird sexism that creeps into sports sites. There's not going to be, like, stuff that your boss... Like, if you're reading my email in the morning, there's nothing that your boss or your kid could see over your shoulder that would put you into trouble. Like, you
right.
guarantee
yeah.
it. Mm-hmm. Other places have success with that stuff, and that's great. But my vision is just to not have that. So by asking people to pay this small fee, either monthly, $4, or yearly, $36, that helps them guarantee that they'll have this for hopefully years to come.
Yeah.
Selfishly, you know, I wanted to own a piece of my own income. Like, the journalism business is such a churn. It's so boom-bust with individual publications, or at least it has been for the life of my own life in this business.
Yeah.
That I thought, I'm 31 years old, almost, and it's time to own something, you know. So
yeah.
even if it's a part-time income or if it becomes a full-time one, so be it. But I want to own it. I don't want a bad investment or a bad paywall strategy that someone else makes determine whether, you know, I have a job in 6 months or a year.
Yeah. I felt that same impulse when I started my newsletter, and if people are unfamiliar with it, I do, it's called The Best of Journalism, and I send out 2 emails a week with links to 3 stories each time, so a total of 6 stories a week. and they're just great long narrative nonfiction. Some stuff that's just been published, some stuff that's totally old. It's kind of random what goes out at a particular time. It's just as I read stuff, whether it's 100 years old or whether it was published yesterday. And, you know, it's my curatorial sensibility, and enough people like that that they're willing to pay $1.99 a month. And I like it in part because if every internet publication goes away in 6 months or 6 years because, the advertising model changes, or because whatever happens, or if they're still around but I get laid off or if I get fired, I still have this piece of my income that is dependent on me and my relationship with these people who like my sensibility. And I'm actually in the interesting position of kind of taking advantage of this shift away from the open internet with a newsletter that very much depends on the open internet, insofar as I'm sending links to people to long-form pieces that are free online. If every place was behind a paywall, presumably I couldn't do this, because people would just subscribe to, the four magazines they subscribe to, and that's the long-form reading that they would do. So I'm curious to see, I think that there are ways that my newsletter could evolve if that happens. It's interesting to be at this time when everything is shifting, and I think that the returns to entrepreneurial journalists are certainly higher than they once were back in an age of where the comparative advantage was almost always to be in, hired by a company to do something.
And the thing is, too, the other thing that this may allow me to do is it allows me to pursue what I'm best at. So I'm best at writing profiles, sometimes long form. Mm-hmm. Now, currently, because, and I have kind of a niche politics, right? I'm one of these dissenting conservatives that was at the American Conservative, et cetera. Well, the staff writer positions at the American Conservative, at least as it's currently constructed, are really better suited for people that were younger, people that, are my age or were my age when I was there.
Right.
Other mainstream outlets are in too much flux to hire me to do this. And I think some of them might be afraid of my politics for some reason. Other magazines I've written for or want to write for, when I talk to them, they're like, well, we love the work you're doing for us as a freelancer. Unfortunately, all of our staff writers or our contract writers, we have too many underperforming contracts right now, so we don't know when we'd be hiring again, but, just keep working for us. So
right. Yeah.
I thought, okay, well, that's great that I have a lot of fans, but let me just do this, If you have underperforming contract writers and that's the reason you can't hire me because you made bad contract decisions, well, I'm going to make a good contract decision with my readers.
Right.
And hopefully they'll think it's a good contract decision too. But by having this source of income, hopefully, that'll helpfully free me up to do what I'm best at. I worked at Business Insider for a while, and it was the most fun I've ever had in that environment. And I learned a lot that I'm actually putting to use in the Slurve about how to sell stories, how to aggregate in a way that's valuable to other people.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think a lot of people, thought that was my best stuff day to day. Mm-hmm. I just serve a different audience. So I prefer this niche approach to my journalism career.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about baseball, about baseball's place in American culture right now. I have to admit right off the bat that it's not a sport that I've followed a ton since I was a little kid. And when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, my grandpa had season tickets to the Angels that he shared with a few other people. So I would go to probably 15 games, 20 games a year, and collected baseball cards like a lot of people. But my baseball knowledge is still kind of stuck back in the time when Wally Joyner and Brian Downing and Bo Jackson were all playing the game. And so, I think of this one $5 Will Clark card that everyone wanted for some reason. And these are kind of the memories I have, you know, the baseball cards that people wanted, the players that that I saw come up to bat and what they would say in Angel Stadium when they came up to bat. I'll occasionally watch like a playoff game or the World Series. But other than that, baseball's kind of slipped away from my consciousness. So I was interested to hear you describe what we're going through right now as kind of a golden age of baseball. And I was curious to hear you kind of flesh out why you think that that's right, why maybe I should go back to following the game.
All right. Well, it's funny because I, as a in high school and in college, I kind of drifted away from sports almost altogether, right? Mm-hmm. It just, it spoke to me a lot as a kid, and then not as much when I was just developing interest in ideas in the world, in politics, etc. But as I came out of college, I still had a lot of friends from high school, and we were all going in different directions. And suddenly I found sports were becoming more interesting to me and more important to me personally and then also socially, that I could still talk to my friends about the teams we liked in common or the teams we hated in common or about a rivalry between teams we rooted for. We could go to games together. And I just found, over time, even as I started writing about politics, I thought, oh, sports writing and sports is trivial. It's so inconsequential compared to the political things I'm writing about. Well, over time, I've come to look at politics as having a lot of triviality in it. I mean, 90%
certainly,
of the content people produce is just trivial garbage. And then baseball particularly kept appealing to me because, like I wrote about in this Daily Beast article, everyone who goes, reporters, fans, when they walk away from the game, they all agree on the facts of what happened. And those facts are recorded and are indisputable. And we know who the winner is. And the losers don't have to feel like they're less American or less dignified in some way. And I don't know, that seemed like such a great, relief from what politics is, where it's just this constant, especially opinion journalists are constantly tempted to, between just telling the truth as they see it, but then also defending the truths that they believe in.
Right.
And so they play, there's this endless status game or one-upsmanship or, just these moral games that people play constantly when they talk about politics that are exhausting. And so, sports is not consequential, but there is a level where it's more real than our political discussion when we talk about sports.
It's interesting.
That's appealed to me.
Yeah, I think I can understand some of the appeal that you're talking about, and I certainly, I guess the sport I watch most these days is basketball, and I occasionally watch tennis too, which I played when I was younger, and it certainly takes me out of the world of politics and seems so much less contentious in so many ways, and I enjoy reading sports writing. In fact, I read about baseball now mostly because I really like Joe Posnanski, read his blog and think that I would read him writing on just about any topic. At the same time, sometimes I'll be in the car and I'll flip through the radio dial and a sports talk radio station will be on, and I always kind of marvel at the similarities between sports talk radio and political talk radio, because I think that the differences you talked about are definitely real, but I think the similarity is maybe a certain tribalism, where you're kind of, you know, you're rooting for your team and you're defending it to the death against all comers, and you're getting very angry about relatively inconsequential things. I don't think that that's as much a part of sports as it is a part of politics. But I think that there is a niche in sports that is kind of like that. I hope that you can just completely steer clear of it in writing about sports, and I think you probably can in a way that you can't when you're writing about politics. It's kind of
part and parcel of it. Yeah, that's probably right. I mean, sports radio is funny in a way. Like, there are even some hosts I still like. Like, Steve Summers in New York is kind of funny. And sometimes the callers are really funny in a way. But you're right. There can be, like, this contentiousness, this obsessiveness, and this sense of vicariousness to it, where somehow the team's glory reflects on the fans, and so then there's this real personal anxiety in some of the callers, and even some of the hosts. Mm-hmm. Although I think that's lightened up just a little bit as the culture of sports have changed, where people now talk about the general manager and the owner and the decisions they make off the field. And there's a lot of what you don't see on talk radio, political talk radio. There's a lot of criticizing your own side, your own team. Sometimes that's the whole purpose, is to just vent. So that's, you're right, it can be contentious. Maybe that's the nature of talk radio generally. The funny thing about sports is it's there's several cultures within it, right? There's a culture of writers, and many of them have a similar background. You know, many of them were kind of nerdier guys who maybe didn't play sports, but they were spectators their whole lives. There's the culture, the broader culture of fans who are not as nerdy and who are more passionate in general, just about their team, their players. And then there's the culture of athletes, which is completely different. And it is funny how they intermix and intermingle. And I think that's one of the funny things about it, is just, like, sports writers often, and I have to avoid this temptation myself, they make, sports, particularly baseball, into a kind of substitute religion, you know, that this is kind of like, that the game itself is a kind of ritual or liturgy that connects us with some basic truths about ourselves, and it brings out courage and determination and all these other virtues,
right?
And then the player comes off the field and starts tweeting about the game, and it never gets quite that deep. You know, the player sometimes will repeat that little bit of language, and often in an interview situation, but when they freely express themselves, it's so much more freewheeling and fun and unself-aware.
There is something, I don't know, I think there's also, for a lot of people, maybe a comfort in baseball that is similar to the comfort that people take, not in religion generally, but in the ritual of religion. You know, I haven't been to many Catholic masses since I didn't get confirmed. But whenever I do go back, whether, you know, sometimes I go with like a family on Christmas or to a wedding or something, there is just a certain familiarity with this thing that just happens every week and is the same in so many ways. It has similarities with listening, you know, turning on the radio for me in Los Angeles and hearing Vin Scully, this announcer that's just been around forever, and is such a good baseball announcer. He's another guy that, you know, I could listen to a Dodgers game on the radio without even really wanting to watch it on TV just because of him. And I feel the same way about Chick Hearn, who was the longtime Lakers announcer, who a lot of people in LA still miss. I don't know. There's certainly ritual and tradition to it, and a comfort in the repetitiveness and the familiarity that I think appeals to a lot of people.
Yeah, it's funny too. There's partly there's also like a chant like quality to the announcing of a game, and I always notice this because I think about the words announcers say, mm-hmm. and like the Mets have this amazing television broadcast team of Gary Cohn, and then they rotate in Keith Hernandez and Ron Darling, two former Met stars, and, mm-hmm. and it's probably one of the just the most skillfully called play by plays, along with just an amazing color team. Very funny. I mean, I know guys who moved to New York from Detroit from other baseball markets, and they're like, I just love watching the Mets games because even if it's a blowout, these guys are just great to listen to. But if you, so if they're one of the best, if you put their words down into text, it becomes much more boring. And there's right. a lot of cliches, right? So it's like, and I have this game where I'm watching the game and then I start like saying what the next line is going to be from the announcer. So like steady diet of fastballs, or like, oh, he's headed for the golden sombrero.
Yeah.
And there's, and they're repeated endlessly. But in itself, that's, that is also a kind of comfort. In fact, the only sports announcer I know who doesn't do that, is this one hockey announcer, Doc Emmerich. And if you ever listen to Doc Emmerich call a hockey game, the number of verbs he uses is astonishing. Like, you know, he pierces that one, he chokes it up in the corner, he, like, you know, every other hockey announcer would just say, oh, Stevens dumps it into the corner.
Right, yeah.
They're going to play a little dump and chase. But for some reason, Doc Emmerich just has prepared, it seems like, between 400 and 500 distinct verbs for each game, and somehow figures out how to use them.
So tell me, what's your, as a longtime fan of the sport, what's your favorite baseball memory?
Favorite baseball memory? You know, as a Mets fan, that's difficult. Because I was, you know, 4 years old when they won the World Series.
Uh-huh.
I have two. I have one, which is there was a 1991 game in September when the Mets were well out of the playoffs, mm-hmm. and David Cohn was pitching. And it was just this crappy game against the Phillies, or so it seemed. And all of a sudden, David Cohn is throwing, you know, strikeout after strikeout after strikeout, most of them looking. And he ended up with 19 strikeouts, and I remember calling up my uncle, you know, I was 9 at the time, and it was just thrilling. And then, you know, since then I've gone to Cooperstown. I think, you know, the jersey he wore that day is in Cooperstown. So that's another one. And then I would say the run the Mets made in 2006 in the playoffs was incredibly exciting. Up until the point when Endy Chavez made this heroic over-the-fence catch in the eighth inning to save the game. Unfortunately, in the next inning, the Cardinals blasted the Mets with a two-run homer, and yeah. Carlos Beltran swung and missed. I have to say that the last one would be Johan Santana's no-hitter for the Mets. It's been a joke that Mets fans have been waiting for this since the beginning of their franchise. They've never had one, despite having all of these great pitchers like Tom Seaver, Nolan Ryan, you know, Ron Darling even. You know, a lot of guys who could have gotten a no-hitter. Mm-hmm. And finally, Santana gets one. And what was funny about that was my friends from high school, for years, whenever a Met pitcher has gotten to about the fifth or sixth inning and he hasn't given up a hit, you would get a text message, or you would send a text message if you were watching, to this small group of friends saying, hey, are you watching the Mets game? You wouldn't say what was happening, but it came to be a thing where if you got that text message, you knew that there was a potential no-hitter happening.
Right.
So you'd know to, like, rush to the television. And unfortunately, one of my friends that night was at a wedding. And I told him to get his head on straight, because weddings happened all the time. Half of them end in divorce. But this Mets no-hitter could be happening right now. Maybe that's my favorite.
I think, certainly one of mine is the Dodgers game when Kurt Gibson hit his famous home run limping around the bases, which I watched on TV along with most of the rest of LA. I think, especially as a little kid, hitting memories are more exciting than pitching memories if you're not a huge baseball fan.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the ultimate thing that even non-baseball fans could understand. This guy's hobbling and he's injured and he's coming up to the plate and he basically has to hit a home run in order to even make it on base. He's hobbling so much. And it was just such a perfect coming together of everything. The other memory that I was, in hindsight, very lucky to be there for, I was actually at the game, at an Angels game, and Reggie Jackson played for the Angels late in his career. And in this particular game, I was there with my two grandfathers and my dad. And my grandfather goes to buy beer for my dad and my other grandpa. And while he's gone, Reggie Jackson hits a home run. And so he comes back to the seat, and they're drinking their beers. And at some point later, he goes to the bathroom, and Reggie Jackson hits another home run. And I promise you, I'm not making this up. My grandpa, later in the game, went to the bathroom again, and Reggie Jackson hit three home runs in that game, and my grandpa missed all of them. And so it's kind of gone down in family lore as something that we always kid him about. But also, it's just amazing to be there for a game where the guy hit three home runs. It doesn't happen very much. Despite my lack of being a huge fan, I definitely have some fond memories of the game.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I'm sorry, I cut you off. Go ahead.
No. I was going to say that's awesome, and the connection between fathers and sons, I think, is a big part of the appeal about baseball now. And in itself, I bet the sport, I think, is going to continue to become more dynastic, where fathers that were in the league will have sons that are in the league. Just because I think they're able to give their... The culture of athletics is now so all-consuming that it is something that almost can be passed down generation to generation.
Right, there's high returns to starting early and training.
Yeah,
the
there's
right ways
and high returns, and then knowing all the best trainers and all these other things, and just being used to the life. But it's also that way for fans, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. So I wanted to transition a bit. You had a piece. I mean, I thought we could change subjects a little bit in case people are wondering why two conservative-ish or critical of the conservative movement writers are just endlessly talking about baseball. You had a piece that's not baseball, so for non-baseball fans.
Yes. I'm sorry, I missed the first part of what you said. Which piece are you talking about?
Wait. You had this piece about we were talking about it earlier, the lobster claw.
Oh, yeah, yes. Thing. Okay, so, there are a couple pieces I'd love to talk with you about real quick. One is that you're familiar with the machines where you go into an arcade and they have the claw and you put in a quarter and you try and get a stuffed animal out of the glass case with this claw that lowers and made most famous in Toy Story, I suppose. And so I was... going to this place that I frequent, the Bear Flag Fish Company, and they have excellent fish tacos of all different sorts. And so I go in one day, and they have this new machine in the corner. What's that? And I go over and I look at it. And it's a claw machine, except instead of stuffed animals inside, it's a live lobster tank as well. And so you put $2 in, and if you can catch a lobster, then they will cook it for you, and you'll get a $2 lobster. If you can't catch a lobster, you'll just have wasted $2. And so, I don't know, this is, I've been thinking about this a lot ever since. Partly because it just seems like, how did no one think of that idea before, right? It's perfect, a lobster claw versus a claw. I don't know. It's something just irresistible about it that appeals to a lot of people and that causes them to put their $2 into the machine.
It feels like something that would be in like a Russell Banks short story about
right.
Maine or something like that. No, it's kind of perfect.
And in addition to thinking about it for that reason, I also thought about it because as a big fan of long-form nonfiction, I thought of David Foster Wallace's piece, Consider the Lobster. And
yeah.
It was interesting watching people go to the machine and try it because a lot of people had kind of the same experience I did, which was that they both kind of felt just impelled to try this thing. Like they really wanted to try it. But they also were kind of relieved in a way when they didn't catch a lobster and felt a little bit uneasy about the whole thing. You know, I'm not a vegetarian, and if I was served lobster on a plate, I wouldn't really have any objection at all to eating it. And yet, having to actually try and catch the thing with this big claw and seeing the lobster kind of resist, kind of scurry away, and then as the claw went back up in the air, it kind of like punched its little claw out as if to try and like hit it. I don't know. It was just a different experience. And I'm sure it sounds ridiculous to anyone who regularly goes out and hunts or who, you know, has worked around animals that were slaughtered or whatever. But for most people who are completely disconnected from the living animal when they eat their food, this is a kind of different experience. And for some reason, the act of, you know, I don't think that the claw would hurt a lobster with its tough shell, but it's somehow different than just seeing the tank in a fancy restaurant where there's a lobster tank and they reach their hand in and grab it.
Right. Well, it's definitely like we're definitely on some level like I think it's easier to imagine yourself as the lobster in the case where the claw is coming.
It's so
down.
True.
So the because we look at it and you know we typically understand animals in human terms. You know, like a lot of times people with dogs, they think when they come home and the dog has done something like, you know, chewed on a shoe or peed on a carpet, and the dog flashes them a look and people say, oh, he looks guilty.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not guilt. The dog is very likely, according to dog scientists, flashing you a look that they know through practice softens your anger at them. So it's just a pure Pavlovian response of trying to re-affiliate themselves with you.
Right.
You know, because you're the source of food and pleasure and everything else, and potentially a source of punishment. But we look and say, it's guilty. So we look at a lobster and we see the claw struggle, and we're like, it's like resistance, you know.
It's like, yeah, no, totally. It's
like resisting King Kong or something. Like if King Kong were to grab me, you know, I would move that way.
So we'll link. I have a piece about this up at the Atlantic where I express my feelings about it more eloquently than I have just now. but be on the lookout because they're out there, and you can also find them on YouTube. As a side note, there's this subculture on YouTube of people who go to the stuffed animal claw machines and videotape themselves getting things and, like, post the YouTube videos as kind of bragging rights. Like, look at all of the things I got with one quarter, or look at all of the things I got in 2 minutes. So it was kind of fascinating to stumble onto that subculture. And I write in my piece about a guy who has a bunch of videos posted of doing that. And he's just like an aficionado of these machines, and he's always going and getting different things and trying to collect different stuffed animals. And then he stumbles upon the lobster machine. And his kind of monologue of how that's different is interesting to watch. So I encourage
that's
people
awesome.
To check it out. The other story I wanted to talk about is quite a bit more serious, actually. It's about the NYPD and the spying program that they launched after the September 11th attacks, when they basically sent out undercover officers and also paid informants to spy on Muslims all over the New York area, so both in New York City and also even out of their jurisdiction in New Jersey and in somewhere else other than New Jersey, but I forget where. And so, this was controversial when the Associated Press revealed that it was happening. And it kind of has been out of the news for a while, but a report just recently came out where some nonprofit workers went in and interviewed a bunch of people from the Muslim communities that were spied upon and talked about how it affected it. And one of the scandalous parts about this is that, you know, people always talk about the trade-off between liberty and security and the notion that we have to do some of these things and a whole range of things. I really, really disagree with that. But in this particular instance, the NYPD has acknowledged that they did not get a single terrorism lead out of all of this. So whatever you think about the propriety of doing it, if you think that maybe it could work out under a different cost-benefit analysis, there really has been no benefit in this case. There were no plots uncovered. There were no leads that led anyone to actual terrorists. What this report really did a good job of focusing on is the costs that you wouldn't expect, not the abstract costs to civil liberties as like a general notion, but the way this changed how people experienced their own communities. And in ways that even as someone who's really opposed to this, I'd never really thought of. So I would talk about how as people started to figure out that the NYPD was paying informants, even before the story broke, but especially after the story broke, there'd be worried mothers who would tell their 18 and 19-year-old college kids who were studying in New York or New Jersey, don't go hang out with the Muslim student groups. Don't go see your friends in their weekly meeting there when they talk about matters of faith, because it's not a safe place to be. You don't want to make yourself a target of the authorities. You don't want to end up on some list or, heaven forbid, get arrested and disappeared. Parents are really concerned and writing to their kids and making them promise, you know, don't go to those meetings. People changing the way that they dressed. Imams talking about how it became impossible to have the kinds of conversations that we associate with, like, you know, a Catholic priest in the confessional or, a rabbi and a congregant. These kind of confidential conversations, not that any great mortal sin is being revealed, but just that, having these frank conversations is impossible when both the congregant and the religious authority figure are both wondering, is this other person an informant who is trying to bait me into saying something controversial? And so I have to be very careful about what I say, and I'm going to react to any speech that's out of the ordinary as if it's kind of potentially false. And then also people talking about how a lot of people within different mosques begin to kind of turn on one another and, accuse people of being informants. And so there was one instance where after the AP story broke, it was revealed that there was an informant on this one mosque trip. I forget if it was like a trip to the beach or some just kind of outing. And a bunch of people accused this one person of being the informant, and it later turned out that it was someone else. But there are a bunch of instances of people either being falsely accused or kind of feeling that everyone was suspecting them and being paranoid about that, whether or not it was accurate. So it was just an eye-opening look into how the notion of the state focusing its attention on you and sending spies into a community just really affects not just the particular people. In this case, no one was charged, but not just people who are like the target of the investigation, but really everyone in the community, and how it in this case just destroyed the ability of a faith community to kind of live out its very purpose to support one another and to talk about matters of religion and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, you can, it's funny. I've been reading on the history of the Irish Troubles and things like that, and it's slightly different, but the fear of British spies and of double agents, etc., sometimes it didn't invade in that kind of personal way. But, it was not uncommon in areas around the border for the IRA effectively to turn its guns on the Irish to police them in order to prevent the English from having to come in and police that community.
Right, yeah.
And this could be really vicious, like blowing out kneecaps and elbows and things like that. And then that level of suspicion and violence breeds its own other aberrations, where now there's this kind of unaccountable system of violence and power that then can be turned on people for, you know, personal reasons having nothing to do with the political reason this system was invented in the first place.
Right.
So it does, you know, it's something, it's a great report you're talking about, because getting to that human level, whereas these things are always talked about, or typically talked about, in just the abstraction of, is it radicalizing a community if we police them in this way, or are we opening ourselves up to terrorism if we don't police them this way?
Right.
And then the conversation kind of stops there. But informing ourselves about the whole way we affect a community through policing, I think, just adds this extra dimension that's really good.
Yeah, and it really, it made me kind of, it really made me realize how much religious communities, because they're this space where everyone there is theoretically there voluntarily and coming together for the same ultimate purpose, even if there are disagreements on various, you know, small matters. Really, everyone is there. You know, they don't have to be there. And so I think part of the power of what people take, the benefits that people get from it, is due to that, to it being a community of people who are all voluntarily there. And that can really be fragile and easily destroyed if suddenly you can no longer kind of presume a good faith on everyone around you. It really changes the character of the thing you're participating in.
Yeah, that's powerful. Well, I think we can leave it there. Everyone,
and before we close, tell people how, if people are interested in your baseball newsletter, how can they find it? How can they sign up?
Oh, well, you just go to www.theslurve.com, and there's two buttons that take you either to the monthly or the annual subscription form, and I made them as easy as possible. You could do it on a mobile phone pretty easily, and then that's it. You start receiving emails the next day, or one email the next day, and then an email after that. And we go 7 days a week during the season. We'll take a day off before the All-Star game, then 7 days a week through the World Series, and then less frequently during the off-season. So on some weeks, there will be, like, during the winter meetings when lots of trade rumors are going on, we'll be coming almost every day. During Christmas, we'll finally leave you alone.
Right.
And we'll also have some features, some original interviews and other essays and things like that in the winter to keep it interesting and worth your money.
All right. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, I will look forward to it.
All right. Take care. And we'll meet on the other side of our newsletter empires.
All right. Sounds good.